Good afternoon, and we're going to open up a joint House Environment and Water and Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee.
Yeah, so I'll open up the House Committee on Environment and Water for this informational meeting on 2007 Senate Bill 737. We're getting updates on progress towards implementing that law.
Great. Thank you, and hopefully we'll have a few more members trickling in, and thanks to our committee staff for arranging this. Before I forget, I would just like to mention that the Senate committee will be meeting on June 9th, next Tuesday, for an informational meeting on navigability. So we decided while we're here, making good use of the time, since we didn't get to hear all the issues that we wanted to during the regular our regular committees. So members, you should have received information, or you will be, from Beth about that. Any other announcements you have?
Nothing on this side.
Okay. So we're going to get started. We have a list of folks that are going to provide us with an update. I just saw Senator Walker racing down the hall, so she'll be back here in a few minutes, but why don't we get started with the Department of Environmental Quality. Senator Walker just wanted to say a few words since we were co-sponsors on the bill last session. We'll hand off on here.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Chair Dingfelder, Chair Cannon. It's really a pleasure for me to be here. I'm Dick Peterson. I'm the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and this is a great opportunity for us to give you a progress report on Senate Bill 737 that was passed in the 2007 session, and we're obligated to bring to the legislative body a report in progress of work, which we delivered on June 1st. With me today is Jennifer Weigel, who's the manager of our water quality standards section, who her and her staff did most of the work on this. Really, before I want to get started, I do want to acknowledge the good work of Senator Walker. Senator Dingfelder, I know you were actively engaged in this and in bringing us to a bill in 2007. I also want to especially thank the Umatilla Tribe, who you'll hear from later today, and also the group of municipalities that worked with us on this, as well as all the other stakeholders that rolled up their sleeves to help us get to this point. We got a slide. We're going to show some slides. Do you turn that on? Okay. Okay, good. Thank you. Working to address toxics across the landscape in Oregon is one of DEQ's strategic directions, strategic priorities. And really, it's an important one for us and for all Oregonians to really think how we address toxics in a holistic way. Senate Bill 737 is really about that, and we're going to talk more about that. Certainly, Oregonians have expressed concern about toxics in the environment and really asked us to look at toxics, us, in a way that's going to keep toxics out of harm's way. And we have really, over the years, we've made great progress regulating toxics through a traditional way, through regulation of point sources, through a lot of really good voluntary measures. I don't want to any way suggest that Oregon, Oregonians, or business community and non-point source community are not working hard on toxics, because they are. This just continues to further that. And what you're going to learn today is Senate Bill 737 is about pollution prevention. It's about community involvement. It's about really helping individuals make individual choices. So I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer, but just in a real brief fashion, what the Senate Bill 737 does is really directed DEQ to compile a list to address the growing concern among Oregonians. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer. Thanks.
Thank you. So Senate Bill 737 contained three broad...
Senator Walker just showed up, and she has to be in another meeting, so if we can ask you just to step aside for a second. She just wanted to say a few introductory comments.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator of District 7, and I'm really pleased that you're having this hearing today so that the public has a chance to see the good work that we did with Senate Bill 737 last session and that the department has done in their study. And there's quite a bit of work left to do. We're continuing to fund that work. And I just wanted to thank everyone for their participation because I think it's very instructive and it will help Oregonians ensure that we have a path to make sure our waterways are clean.
Great, and thank you for your support to make sure we continue funding this important program.
All right, thank you. I'm off to public safety sub.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
No problem.
We picked up another member, so that was a good good tactic as well.
Okay.
Welcome.
So Senate Bill 737 contains three major requirements, the first being to develop a list of priority persistent biocumulative toxics by June 1st of 2009. We delivered on that earlier this week. The next phase for us is going to be to identify sources and opportunities for reduction for those pollutants and to develop a report identifying those sources and opportunities for source reduction and deliver that legislative report by June 1st of next year. The other major requirement is for the largest Oregon municipalities to develop toxic reduction plans by July of 2011 for pollutants that are detected in their effluent above trigger levels for those pollutants that are contained in the priority persistent pollutant list. As Dick mentioned, this project focuses on priority persistent pollutants, and that term, fortunately for us, is defined in the legislation. It's a bit of a tongue twister. And it is those pollutants that come from a wide variety of sources but linger in the environment or accumulate through the food chain from a variety of sources and have a documented effect on human health, wildlife, and aquatic habitat. DEQ was specifically directed to identify chemicals meeting defined characteristics. And those three characteristics were toxicity and either persistence or bioaccumulation. The either persistence or bioaccumulation is also important to note because there are many PBT lists, as they're known, persistent bioaccumulative toxic lists that exist. And many of those lists address pollutants that are toxic, persistent, and bioaccumulative. The use of the word or here does create a broader definition than exists in other lists that have been developed by other jurisdictions to date. The list development so far and identifying of these chemicals, that constitutes the majority of the work that we've done thus far in developing the list. To develop this list, we convened a science work group of seven experts. Their fields of expertise included things such as fate and transport, hydrology, human health, aquatic life, and wildlife toxicology. DEQ tasked them with advising us on the process to identify potential persistent pollutants. DEQ's process included the use of EPA models to evaluate over 2,000 chemicals based on toxicity, persistence, and bioaccumulative characteristics. As a result of this process, DEQ developed a draft list of 175 persistent pollutants that we published and solicited public comment on during March of 2009. During that public comment period, we held public information sessions throughout the state and used many other means of public outreach to reach other interested parties during that period of time. As a result of that public comment period and our outreach efforts, we received a significant number of comments. We evaluated those comments, and as a result, we identified some new information that were contained in those comments and through which we learned on our own during that period of time, and also understood that there were significant updates to the model that we used. As a result, we identified a number of pollutants that met our criteria that should be included on our list that people did not see in the draft list in March. We wanted to offer an opportunity for interested parties to provide additional information on those pollutants. So based on those reasons, DEQ decided to have an interim P3 list. In addition, we wanted to recognize the focus of the legislation, which is on pollution prevention, keeping pollutants out of the water. As a result of these considerations, the interim P3 list has three tiers. The first tier we are calling the persistent pollutant tier. These are pollutants that were contained on our draft list and for which we received no request from any interested stakeholders to remove or to submit additional data on those pollutants. The second tier we are calling the legacy persistent pollutant tier. These are pollutants that are no longer in use but continue to be found in water, and these pollutants also continue to have significant environmental effects but are unlikely to be many new opportunities for reduction. There are many existing ongoing efforts that we wish to encourage and continue to occur, but in terms of looking to for source reduction as solutions to these pollutants, those opportunities are likely to be more limited. For the third tier, we are calling this the persistent pollutant tier under review. There are several types of reasons whereby pollutants may be listed under this tier. The first is for those pollutants that DEQ published in its draft list in March, and we received public comments that they be removed. For these pollutants, we will be, as well as the others in Tier 3, we will be soliciting focused information and data to either corroborate or refute some of the model conclusions that we found. The second reason that some pollutants may have found their way onto this tier were for those pollutants that we received public comment asking that they be added, and once we ran them through our process, found that they met our persistent pollutant criteria and are now newly added to the list. The last reason with which pollutants may be found on this tier are those pollutants that were, once we upgraded our model and process, we reran some of the pollutants that had dropped out earlier and found that some, based on model upgrades, were now met our criteria. And again, those were not published as part of our March list, so we would like to have interested stakeholders have an opportunity to comment on those and give us additional focused information and data.
I'm going to interrupt you for a question on this. I just want to be clear. These three tiers then have no relationship to the, you know, toxicity or the persistence of the pollutants on the list. Instead, reflect to some extent how much consensus there is or lack of consensus about the degree to which these really qualify as a persistent pollutant. Is that right?
Chair Cannon, that would definitely be true for the distinction between Tier 3 and the other two tiers on the list.
Uh-huh.
And then you're correct that they do, that placement in a tier does not reflect the degree to which they are persistent toxic relative to each other, toxic, persistent, or bioaccumulative.
And do you intend, I noticed that you'll be releasing a final list later this year, do you intend on that list to follow a, I don't know if it's a tiering system, but some sort of rating that will address relative levels of toxicity, persistence, et cetera? I'm just a little concerned. I understand the kind of consensus approach. Put some ones that you think are bad out there, see if anybody objects, and if they don't, well, they're probably bad. But I would hope that we get to the point where we're able to say, well, in the estimation of DEQ based on best available science, these are the ones that are worst. Mm-hmm. These are the ones that are we should be paying particular attention to. These are the ones that probably are a lower priority.
Mm-hmm. Chair Cannon, at this point in time, what our plans are between now and October, I'll get to a little bit more detail in just a moment. Between now and October, we intend to have a significant amount of effort put toward reviewing the data that we get. The next significant phase of this project will be to get a better understanding of the degree to which these pollutants occur in Oregon's environment and opportunities for source reduction. I think that will also play a very important part in determining what pollutants are most important for Oregon to be addressing and where there are the greatest opportunities to do source reduction. At this point in time, we had not planned on tiering the pollutants with the October list. I think it is something important for us to consider, and we're continuing to have ongoing dialogue with our other stakeholders as well. But I think there may be a very good opportunity to have those kinds of conversations as we simultaneously collect information on where these pollutants are, the degree to which they're in Oregon's waters, and opportunities for reduction that could also inform how important they are in addition to their chemical characteristics.
Thank you.
Relative to the data review for those pollutants that have been placed in Tier 3, We distributed a memo concurrent with the publishing of our list on June 1st, in which we requested additional information to refine the estimates of the toxicological and persistent and bioaccumulative characteristics. In that memo, we detailed a process for submitting data and will be affording an opportunity for interested parties to fill data gaps for those pollutants by the end. Through the end of July 2009. Following that, we will be evaluating the data through August and September, and based on this evaluation, we expect that those pollutants that are now contained in Tier 3 will either move to Tiers 1 or 2 or drop from the list by October 2009. As you can see, you should all have copies of the executive summary in front of you. And in there, there's a little bit more detail that gives some examples of the kinds of pollutants and some of their uses and sources. As you can see, there are a variety of pollutants from a variety of sources that are included in this list that we've published. The list that we developed was focused, as I've already touched on briefly, the persistence, bioaccumulation, and toxicity characteristics of the individual chemicals. And as you can, some of the different kinds of sources and uses and types of pollutants that are on our list include things such as pharmaceuticals and personal care products, industrial chemicals, flame retardants, global legacy contaminants, active ingredients in pesticides and herbicides, as well as other chemicals that also meet the persistence, bioaccumulation, and toxicity criteria that we established. As I've mentioned briefly, another important aspect of this project is doing what we can to confirm the presence of these pollutants in sediment water or fish tissue. The list that we've developed to date incorporates some information where that was readily available and brought to our attention during the process, but we expect over the next year, as we focus our efforts on doing source identification, that we will be able to gather additional information where that information exists. We'll also be seeking out, working with our own toxics monitoring program to build a body of knowledge about what the agency knows about these toxics, and we'll also be seeking out information from experts in specific areas that can speak to the use and presence of these pollutants in Oregon's waters. So coming up for us, now that we've completed the first phase of this project, over the summer, as I mentioned, we will be accepting and evaluating the information that we received to refine the interim list. We will also be working to begin to gather information for the trigger level selections and sources of pollutants. As I mentioned in one of the first slides, a major requirement of this is for the municipal wastewater treatment plants to develop toxic reduction plans where levels in their effluent exceed levels specified by DEQ, and we've been calling that the trigger levels that we need to establish by rule. In fall of 2009, the final list will be delivered to the legislature in October, and we will begin the formal rulemaking process for those trigger levels. I've touched a little bit on the source identification and source reduction effort that we'll be undergoing. The majority of this effort we expect to take place during the fall and winter, and we view this as a pretty significant effort to be able to look and seek out existing data to identify sources of those pollutants that are on the list. And we'll also be, to the extent that we can identify any available data, we'll be looking at and attempting to evaluate the magnitude, loading, and amounts of these pollutants present in Oregon's waters. A key piece of this is also being able to identify reduction opportunities for these pollutants, and we intend to work with knowledgeable experts both in and outside of DEQ and anyone who has expertise on any of these pollutants to help us document and identify current and new opportunities to reduce pollutants in Oregon's waters. We think this effort is key, and we intend to also partner with other significant work efforts that are going on right now within DEQ, such as the Toxics Reduction Strategy, which also has a similar component to it to identify current efforts and opportunities for new efforts to reduce levels of toxic pollutants in our environment. As I've mentioned, over the fall and winter, we'll be working significantly on the source reduction and control planning phase. We will also be entering the formal rulemaking process to develop trigger levels. In June 2010, the legislative report will be completed. Again, the legislative report is targeted specifically toward documenting and describing opportunities for source control and reduction and identifying sources of these pollutants. In late summer of 2010, we intend to present our rulemaking containing the trigger levels to the Environmental Quality Commission for rule adoption. And at that point in time, the 52 largest municipal wastewater treatment plants will then begin testing their effluent for these priority persistent pollutants. By July 1st, 2010, the municipal wastewater treatment plants are required to deliver their toxic reduction plans to DEQ for pollutants exceeding those trigger levels. Those toxic reduction plans will then be incorporated by reference into their respective NPDES and WPCF permits once those permits are up for renewal. And one note I would like to make for the toxic reduction plans is that we expect the toxic reduction plans to include the types of activities that municipalities have the authority to be able to regulate, require, or provide information to the general public about. The legislation itself gives several examples of different types of pollution prevention measures that might be included in municipal toxic reduction plans. And those types of measures include things such as collecting legacy pesticides, reducing the use of mercury amalgams by dental offices, collecting arm cuts from blood pressure monitors, recycling rechargeable batteries, managing sediments contaminated with persistent pollutants, and instituting pharmaceutical take-back programs. We expect a significant component of the municipality's plans to focus on pollution prevention and public education. And where we're headed from here, we'll be continuing to work to involve interested and affected entities in all phases of this work. There are many aspects of this work where we hope and we expect to have input, thoughts, advice all throughout this. There will be both formal opportunities through the rulemaking phases and informal opportunities as we have individual meetings with different sector groups, stakeholder groups, and the like. We also intend to continue to work with state agencies, DEQ programs, and other groups to coordinate our activities to make sure that our efforts that we're doing here are complementary and not contradictory to other efforts that may be addressing similar chemicals or pollutants.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'm just wrapping up real quick here. And developing this P3 list and the next steps here is probably one of the most rigorous things that DEQ will be involved in. And certainly, as far as I'm concerned, we're off to a very good start in terms of making, again, one of the most challenging and important and informed lists and outcomes that we can make it. And involving stakeholders, getting everybody involved in making right choices here is key to that. And I do want to emphasize that the community-based toxic reduction approach is really what we're trying to accomplish here, and we have many examples around Oregon where that has worked, and this will expand on that. Really, that's what we're trying to achieve in the end, is really to do whatever we can as Oregonians in a collaborative way, in a thoughtful and choice way, keeping things out of the environment where they can create serious problem and harm. And really is a start of kind of a new approach for Oregon and for DEQ, where it's not purely about regulating. It's really about toxics reduction, community choices, and layering it with good scientific information so we're focused on the right things. And as I said before, pollution prevention really is the key here. Certainly local municipalities, the 52 that will be working very hard on this and in a rigorous approach, will do a lot to help educate their communities who they end up managing the waste through their discharge system, and this gives them the opportunity to go up the pipe, if you will, to help keep things out of going through their system in a way that's more like a toxics reduction approach than a regulatory approach. And again, this presents a great challenge and an opportunity for DEQ and for Oregonians. I'm pleased that the legislature gave us that challenge. You have my commitment as DEQ director that this is going to be an integrated approach where we want to make sure we do it right, in a very thoughtful and collaborative way, and I think it's important for Oregonians, and we're taking the right step to get there, what your intent was when you gave us the bill. So with that, we can answer questions or move back and let others talk about it.
I'm going to take a few questions.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Director Peterson, and thank you for the presentation and for your hard work. We know we gave you a lot of sort of a big task last session, and it's really exciting to see the results so far. I do have a few questions, but I'd like to first see if either of my members have any questions. Okay.
Over here.
Go ahead. Okay. A couple things. When you were developing and looking at these lists, I saw that you conferred with US EPA. Did you also talk to other states? Because I'm assuming we're not the first state to ever develop this type of list, and given the limited resources we have, and I know that other states have looked at this. So could you sort of talk about some of the other states and interactions you've had with them?
Sure, Chair Dingfelder. Actually, Oregon is, to our knowledge, the first state to develop a list in such a way as we've developed it. We did confer, probably the most well-known, what may be known to folks here, is that Washington State does have a persistent bioaccumulative toxics list. Their list is slightly different from ours, and their focus is different from ours. Ours is a water-focused list. Theirs is a more comprehensive toxics list, so theirs includes things that might be of concern based on different kinds of exposures, kids eating, chewing on toys, things like that, whereas ours is more is water focused. California, I believe, has some list as well, but other than that, we have been unable to identify a state that has a list similar to ours. We did look to other jurisdictions outside of states, Canada, US EPA's lists, other lists that have been established through UN treaties and protocols. We all use those processes and lists to inform our own. And in fact, we used those lists to form the building blocks of what we considered in our process. We compiled as many of those lists of chemicals of concern that might be that had pollutants that might potentially be considered PBTs, and compiled those as our starting point for considering our own. And that initial list was the one that represented over 2,000 pollutants that we started with on day one.
Okay, and another question I had is, and I don't know if you can go back to some of the recommendations, or next steps, I guess it would be, that one. And you talked about the 52 wastewater treatment plants that are going to be developing, I'm sure some are probably in the process of developing pollution prevention plans, and that will be incorporated into their NPDES permits and wastewater permits. I didn't hear any talk about non-point source. Mm-hmm. And looking at these lists, at the P3 list, some of these obviously are coming out of point source, but there's also we've pesticides, pharmaceuticals. I guess you can say they're a point source, coming from point source, but other inputs where they are, hard to tell where it's coming from. So certainly I know you have jurisdiction over both point source and non-point source, along with other agencies. So can you talk a little bit about your strategy to address reducing inputs through non-point source?
Maybe I'll take a shot at that. Chair Dingfelder, thank you for that question. We're certainly following what the requirement of the statute is, which is to work with municipalities, develop the trigger levels, and then incorporate it into the NPDES permit. Our intent is this becomes very good and valuable information on, because what we're looking at in terms of PBTs as they affect water in Oregon, where are potentially the problems that we have, and this can be an informed opportunity for not only point sources but non-point sources. And it also say we have some really good success in non-point sources, and I think this is going to be an opportunity to do more of that. The example that comes just immediately to mind, and this is just one, is in the Hood River Basin and working with orchardists out there, where we identified some problems in one of the streams out there. We work with the orchardists, and they changed their practices, and actually the levels of certain toxics went down in water. So we're looking at it as maybe an opportunity to be more informed and collaborative, and if there's opportunities in non-point source arena, we'll work with our sister agencies and stakeholders on plans that they might be interested in developing.
Okay, thank you. And I know we're going to hear from some other folks in a little bit that are representing, working with non-point source inputs. So, any other questions?
Okay,
thank you very much, and stick around. There might be some others down there.
Thank you.
Down the road. Thank you again for the presentation, and I'm very excited to have Catherine Brigham from the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla here today. It's a great honor to have you here. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon. My name is Catherine Brigham. I go by Cat. I am the Board of Trustees Secretary for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, which is located in eastern Oregon. First, I want to thank all of you for being able to look at the future, planning for the future. I think in looking at the future, we have to look at how we're going to take care of our land, because the tribal people have always been taught that if we take care of the land and our natural resources, the land will take care of us. And I don't think there's anybody who can live without water, air, or land. So I think it's really important. And I'd also like to thank the EQ Director, Dick Patterson, and the staff, because I think they've been very instrumental in bringing us together. It's not an easy task, as you're pointing out. It's a difficult task, but when we work together to develop a collaborative effort and working together to find solutions, I think we can accomplish a lot, and we have. And by getting the 52 municipal people to come up and say, you know, we're ready to step up, I think is a great achievement. It's not going to be easy, but at the same time, them stepping up is great, and I think by having one group step up, hopefully learning that we make a difference, then we will hopefully get others to step up as well. But it's something that I think we all need to do in working together to develop that collaborative effort. I think what Oregon is doing is great. I think you're stepping up, as you were asking earlier, you know, where is the list? As another state has a list. I don't think I know of any states having a list either, so I think Oregon is taking the lead, and I think it's very good that we are taking the lead. And the nine tribes here are also very pleased, and we'll continue to work with the tribe or states in trying to find a solution on how to deal with the toxins in the state of Oregon. I think it's, you know, tribes live off the land. And so when, you know, one of the concerns is fish consumption rates, and we're also working on that. And so when we talk about the resources, we're talking about preserving our culture, our way of life, and on protecting our tribal treaties. And we recognize that when we are working to protect these resources, we are not only working to protect them for ourselves, but for everybody in the region. So this is something we're very pleased to be stepping up and working with you on. We think this is necessary because sometimes, you know, you just can't get people to step up unless there is a law. But at the same time, I think, you know, with the law being there, it will help us all lead towards finding a solution to help making our environment a much better environment for the future. As we all know, there was at one point in one time, you could go to any tributary in the Pacific Northwest and put your hand in that water and drink it. Today, you can't do that. I mean, in the 1950s, the tribes were able to drink water from the Columbia River. We had to quit drinking that water because we were getting sick, because of the toxins that were coming into the Columbia River. Now you have heard many tribal leaders say, you cannot pay me to drink that water, but our goal is to try to get that water clean and pure and cool again. So just want to thank you, and we will work with you in helping us find a solution for improving things.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, any questions? Okay. Thank you. We really appreciate all the hard work of your staff, I know, has been very, very involved working on the fish consumption issue and all the time and effort that you've spent on that. And we really appreciate your hard work.
Thank you. I think when we have good staff stepping forward and helping us, it's great. Thank you.
Thanks.
We've asked five folks to spend a few minutes each giving their perspectives on this process so far. And so let's start with Daniel Eisenbeis, Terry Witt, and Jeff Stone. See Jeff, Terry, Dane. Great. And just so folks know, we will need to close this committee, at least this half of the committee, at 4 o'clock. So we'll move quickly here through the last...
The whole committee at 4.
Yeah, whole committee at 4.
Chair Dingfelder, Chair Cannon, members of the committees, for the record, I'm Daniel Eisenbeiss with the League of Oregon Cities. Happy to be here today. Thank you for inviting me to testify. Oregon Cities have been willing partners in the effort that's before you today, supporting Senate Bill 737, and I'd like to begin by saying that from our perspective, DEQ has done very good work to date in terms of a very rigorous scientific review and being very clear about their methodology thus far. Our support has come already in the form of paying our 52 municipal treatment plants, the 52 that will be developing plans both from cities and from districts, have paid a two-year surcharge to help fund two positions at the department to do the work that's been done to date. And then we also, with the Oregon Association of Clean Water Agencies, helped put together a technical report about how this development of this sort of list had been conducted in other parts of the world to inform the effort at DEQ. Aside from that, we're supportive of toxic reduction efforts and pollution prevention efforts. Some of our members worked with the department and other organizations to sponsor a mercury waste collection event in April of 2009 at a conference of the Oregon Dental Association, collecting almost 840 pounds of mercury-containing materials and lead foil. What we've come to find is that pollution prevention is the most effective way to reduce pollutants, and we are really, in the municipal sense, dealing with pollution that is conveyed to our treatment plants. But those treatment plants are based upon technology that was developed to protect public health from disease-causing bacteria and viruses, and to remove solids and materials that rob oxygen from wastewater. They were not developed to remove all of these pollutants. The technology, physical and biological treatment systems, does remove some of the toxics, but not all of the toxics of concern. But aside from the technological challenges, pollution prevention at its source is the most cost-effective way to go about keeping these persistent and bioaccumulative toxins out of our waterways. Our anticipation is that the plans that our members put together will be focused on public education and outreach to the public, businesses, and industry about how people and businesses can reduce their use of these compounds. Many of these compounds are pharmaceuticals, personal care products, and cleaning products, so outreach to the public, obviously, about alternative materials in those categories will be important. But as we look forward, I do want to note for the committees that the timeline that's set forth in Senate Bill 737 is very aggressive. We believe that we can meet the challenge, but there will be significant challenges in terms of DEQ completing its work and EQC completing its rulemaking process, and then cities transitioning to the required monitoring for pollutants that may be present in wastewater treatment effluent and developing plans for those compounds that are present in the effluent. It may be that we develop higher quality plans if we have had a bit more time before needing to submit those plans to DEQ. So I think that's something that we should all think about as we look at the timelines that DEQ has developed. And aside from the monitoring and plan development, obviously municipalities need to budget for that work. And just the sort of timing in the fiscal year is important as well.
Mr. Eisenbeiss, if you would wrap up.
Sure.
And move on.
I just want to sort of lastly note that the real value in all of this is the framework that this will provide for the state and for communities and for other sectors as well as we look for ways to reduce pollution in our waterways. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Mr. Witt.
My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Thank you, Chairs, for the opportunity to speak. I will keep my remarks very short. I've got longer comments in writing. We are not only speaking on behalf of Oregonians for Food and Shelter today, but also Crop Life America and another organization called RISE, and you can see what their memberships constitute. I think, like most, we perhaps lost track or lost sight of Senate Bill 737 after it was passed in the 2007 session until basically March of this year, when a public notice was put out for comment on the draft P3 list. It was at that time that we realized that the draft P3 list contained a significant number of pesticides, both currently registered pesticides with current labels, metabolites of pesticides, and also what's known as legacy pesticides, those that are no longer labeled for use, the classic being DDT and chlordane. When we started looking into the process that was used to screen and create these lists, it became apparent that the primary tool was a model that's known as the PBT Profiler. And the PBT Profiler, in its preamble, very clearly states that it is a screening tool to be used where there is lack of experimental or laboratory data on the compounds. When you look at the subset of pesticides, for example, pesticides require a very rigorous set of studies and toxicological data in order to be registered. They are not like most other chemicals. We're talking about 150 tests at the cost of probably $150 million to register a pesticide today. They are very, very well studied. So our registrants, the people who register these chemicals for use, were concerned that some of the chemicals were being put on the list solely on modeling assumptions rather than using exact data that has been generated and given to the EPA to register these materials. I contacted Dick Peterson at DEQ, and Dick and his staff were very, very open and willing to discuss the concerns and the problems that we had to try to work out a process by which we could involve our regulatory scientists and get the necessary data and the robust data from the registrants to the DEQ so they could, in essence, plug the right numbers in rather than use a model to plug the numbers in. And as you saw on the list, the Tier 3 list, there is a pretty significant chunk of chemicals that were on the initial draft list that are now in that up for additional review category, and many of those are in fact the pesticides where the registrant had considerable data to supply. We really appreciate Director Peterson and his efforts and the others, Bruce Hope and Cheryl and Christine and Jennifer. They've all been very good to work with, very approachable. And we have, in fact, continued to offer our expertise from the individual companies, particularly in the next two phases. It will be extremely important to have folks who understand these materials to help in establishing the monitoring analytical methods as well as establishing triggers. So we will continue to work closely with them. A few more points. I think it is important to note, and you'll see it in my testimony, that the mere detection of chemicals in our environment today does not really constitute risk. It really does take a look at how much do we have, because our analytical technology in some cases is down to parts per quadrillion. That is an infinitesimally small amount of material. And from our perspective, the chemicals that are being put on the list, if they're put on the list in error, creates a significant problem for the registrant, but more importantly, creates an even bigger problem for the user community. And in our case, that's the farm and forest community, because these materials are given a black eye or a bad name that they don't deserve. And we all know what happens when that occurs, that regulatory action typically winds up following in some way, shape, or form. Pesticides, fertilizers, and biotechnology are uniquely important to protect us from disease and protect our property from destructive insects and to provide abundant and affordable food for an ever-increasing world population.
Yep. Mr. Witt, I'm going to ask you to finish up.
I will finish up with one sentence. Like the tribes, I think We are trying to work to protect a way of life in Oregon as well, and one that lives off the land, and that's called farmers and foresters. We need these products. We are very judicious about the use of them, and we rely solely on scientific data to ensure that they can be used safely according to the label. Thank you.
Thanks, and thanks for providing written testimony as well as your letter to DEQ on their comments on their list. Appreciate that. And Mr. Stoke?
If I just might add before Jeff jumps in, the main reason I supplied that was a letter that we had submitted to DEQ during the public comment period, was the last page. There's a chart on there that really does kind of show the significant number of pesticides that were on that initial list and perhaps why some of our registrants were concerned. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff?
Mr. Chair, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. Hopefully I'll be mercifully brief. We have submitted a letter that we provided DEQ during the rulemaking process, which I hope expands on what I'm going to say to you today. But a couple things have occurred to us as we have met with DEQ is trying to examine the feasibility of pesticide reductions in and of themselves and the cost and availability of alternative methods. That's important to us. And what's the magnitude of the impact on the waters in the state? So are you measuring during a rain event? Because with soil erosion, we fight against that frequently. If you're a container nursery or a Christmas tree grower, having soil run off and get into the waters, if you measure at that moment, there's going to be a higher level, and whether or not that's a static level or not is really the question that we wish to pose. We also come to a point where we want to work with DEQ about what are the reduction goals. I mean, what do you want to accomplish? What are the true risk factors that Mr. Witt talked about? And are trigger levels going to be elevated as a water quality standard? Because, you know, we think that all those things in combination can change the practices of the nursery and greenhouse industry. We want to be good stewards of the land. And words matter. With Senate Bill 737, it was about the health of humans and animals and the waters of the state. Not or, but it was both. So that's an important distinction as we look forward in working with DEQ. The last thing I would say is that what Mr. Eisenbeiss talked about, which is some of the cost to the municipalities, we're cognizant of that because those costs will be passed on to the ratepayers. And so we want to make sure that all the reduction plans are something that are attainable by the 52 cities. That goes down as low as Wilsonville as a city. So if you look at kind of the hierarchy of how big a city, it goes to Wilsonville, where we're located. And so I would just ask that we be thoughtful on how we move forward. We look forward to working with DEQ and trying to get the best product on the ground. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks very much. Appreciate you three being here. Catherine Venetta and Ivan Maliski. Go ahead, Ms. Venetta.
Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association, here today to talk a little bit about pulp and paper's role so far in the 737 process and share our success story on dioxin, usually something someone doesn't really want to talk about that much. But first of all, we've participated in the stakeholder group that DEQ has, and we currently have a PhD analytical chemist working on DEQ's methods work group. So we are participating in this process and watching this. And we have commented on the draft interim list. And we're currently looking at those lists to see whether we have any chemicals of concerns in our processes also. But directly to Tier 2 of the list, legacy chemicals, if you have a copy of the list, you'll notice that the first chemical listed is 2378-TCDD dioxin as a TEQ, a total equivalency quotient. And so we're not quite sure what that means, but in the meantime, we'll be discussing that with DEQ. But I wanted to share, because you might not have heard, the success story that this state and Washington has enjoyed on dioxin as it relates to the pulp and paper mills. In the late 1980s, when we found it in our effluent due to the EPA surveys that they did of the water, and they did find it in fish tissue, we immediately started looking inside of our processes for what was causing it to combine with the chlorine molecules from our bleaching, because it was associated with bleach craft pulp and paper mills. And we found in the pollution prevention phase that it had to do with chemicals that we use to wash our pulp, wash the wood that makes the paper, basically. So when we changed the processes, but then in the regulatory process that ensued to try to regulate this chemical, we did a lot of regulatory stuff, and we did a lot of lawsuits. And we did a lot of regulation after that. And really what we think is that some of the early measures that we took had great strides in reducing the amount of this toxic to the environment and in our process. And then finally, in the early parts of this decade, the cluster rule for the pulp and paper industry, which looked at our processes from top to bottom and toxics from the air, water, and land, and looked at reducing those, but in a cross-media fashion, so there wasn't any transfer of toxics from one from air to water, say, or something like that. When we started meeting our technology-based standards, which called for the use of no elemental chlorine in bleaching of our pulp, we have, we're happy to report that we are non-detect at the bleach plant. That means that we measure routinely inside of our processes, and we can't find any there at the detection level. And since that time, DEQ, through its toxics water quality standards process, has reduced the dioxin water quality standard, and we still meet it. So that's my success story and how pollution prevention can and does help do things, and how if you can work collaboratively with your suspected sources, that sometimes it's a lot easier and everybody ends up spending a lot less money to get the first reductions. And then after that, it's debatable.
Thank you, Ms. Bonetta.
Chair Ziegfelder and Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. Thanks for having this hearing today. I recognize we're short on time. Keep it brief. We had the opportunity to work on this bill last session. We had a great time working with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla, the municipalities, and some of the other stakeholders, and really want to commend their role in making this happen. This bill ultimately, it started, for those of you who remember, as a regulatory bill that was focused on point source pollution from both industrial and municipal sources. Ultimately involved, it evolved to become more of a roadmap, if you will, for toxics reduction and future and pollution prevention that took a broad approach from of both point and non-point sources. I think I can tell you, having been part of the stakeholder process, that the Department of Environmental Quality has been very diligent in seeking out the best science and seeking out well-informed scientists to be involved in the development of this list, and have been listening to a lot of stakeholders. I think it's an evolving process. I think that we will know more as we start to do the actual research and how these chemicals are actually accumulating in sediment, water, fish, and plant tissue, and I think that will really help inform the next step. And you know, lastly, I guess I would say that if there's anything that this legislature could do, if you're going to look in the future at opening up 737, one element we might suggest is right now just the municipalities have to submit pollution reduction plans as part of this bill. We think there would be value in having the industrial point source polluters similarly have to submit at least these plans that the municipalities are obligated to, and that would be one thing we'd suggest in the future if you ever look at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Seeing no questions, I will close the House Committee on Environment and Water.
And I will close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. And just a reminder, we're going to have an informational hearing next week on navigability.